Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our last Brown Bag Seminar of the year.
Hard to believe.
And it's hard to believe. Dr. Ty Redden is our guest today, and as someone who's from the South and now at Gettysburg, the first time in Pennsylvania, we were working on dates, and we never would have thought that this week would have potentially been a snow out. So we're happy that it snowed a couple days ago and that you've been able to make it. And everyone, I'm Sabina Dietrich, co-director of the Urban Regional Analysis Program at the University Center for Social and Urban Research and faculty member here at the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs at GISPIA. Ty Redden is an urban planner by training, but we've decided she'll tell you a little bit about some of that, but her interdisciplinary background crosses over into anthropology and political science, and her work examines housing, urban governance, and social policy. Before receiving her PhD at the University of Florida in Design, Construction, and Planning, she was employed by DeKalb County Government as an Economic Development and Housing Research Program or an analyst in the Metro Atlanta area. And her talk today will be based on a dissertation research on forcible evictions preceding the 2016 Summer Olympics in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. And for our transportation planners, one of my colleagues and longtime friends, Bruce Steiner, Professor Steiner, is on Dr. Redden's PhD committee, and we were talking beforehand about how Bruce Steiner, as a transportation planner, pushed her in some ways that she didn't start out and then kind of changed some of the things that she did. And it was very relevant to what's going on today in our area in Allegheny County with discussions about the BRT and then some closing of longtime bus routes. So we'll get into that. Her work argues that the evictions coupled with strategic disinvestment and transit nodes were a complement of a much larger municipal plan of urban apartheid, and the study links hyper-commodification of the urban landscape to urban government's failures and asserts a healthy community of scholar activists that exist globally, leveraging their academic skill sets to address social inequities. She is currently a visiting professor at Gettysburg College, conducting grant-sponsored research, also a neighborhood resilience study in Gainesville. At Gettysburg, though, where she's teaching some courses, Housing and Race in the U.S., and the one I want to take, Black Bodies and American Sporting. So we've had a time to talk to Ty about some of her other pieces of research, but today, Ty, welcome to Pittsburgh and the GISPIA and UXER, and we look forward to urban apartheid in the 2016 Olympics.
Thank you so much. So thank you for having me. I want to talk to you all today about what started out as my dissertation research and became the foundation of my continuing research in the Global South on forced evictions, particularly how mega sporting events impact marginalized communities. So in my preliminary research, what I found was that developing countries in the Global South are dominating the hosting of mega sporting events, right? So commonly known as the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, these were countries that were referenced as emerging economies, right? Particularly in the early 2000s. And what I found was, as the global downturn of 2008 was causing developed countries to shy away from hosting these mega sporting events, that developing countries were eager to host them, right? So I was a doctoral student at the University of Florida in search of a research topic, right? And I happened upon a news story about forced evictions preceding the 2016 Olympics, right? So trained in economic development and framing myself as a housing planner, I was really interested in the fact that these forced evictions were taking place in favelas, which are informal settlements. Rio has about 600 such settlements throughout the city and on the peripheries. And so I decided, you know, there are worse places to do field research than Brazil, right? So I went to the Center for Latin American Studies and found an expert and told her, you know, teach me what you know of Brazil, right? And she said, who are you? Urban planning? Don't you all have urban planners over there who do international research? As she's taking books off her shelf for me to read about Brazil, right? And so I enrolled in an accelerated Portuguese class because I realized I don't speak Portuguese. And so just a few short months later, I was on a plane because the Olympics happen once every 4 years. So either you go or you don't, speaking far less Portuguese than I thought I did. And my plan was to conduct ethnographic interviews with a variety of stakeholders. I had nurtured a network of personnel from the Housing Secretary's Office in Rio, the Inter-American Developmental Bank, community organizations on the ground like Catalytic Communities, an NGO there, and potential contacts who could put me in contact with these residents who were facing eviction, right? And so, as I started to familiarize myself more with Brazil and the situation in Rio, I used methods such as document review to really understand the full context of what was going on and what had been going on in Rio in the past few years. And so what I found was that in 2009, Rio de Janeiro was announced as the 2016 host of the Olympics, right? And so this was under the administration of Lula da Silva, who was the world's most popular politician. Hard to imagine. When he left office, he literally had the highest approval rating of any politician in the world. Brazil had been cited as an emerging economy. They were on the cover of The Economist, and the headline was Brazil Takes Off. Their economy was booming, and through investment in social welfare, millions were being lifted out of poverty. That was 2009. Okay? So by the time the Olympics were closely approaching, Brazil's fortunes had drastically changed. It was actually in the worst recession in the country's history. But it still had to put on the 2014 World Cup, and it still had to put on the 2016 Olympics. And so my research questions really focus on the role of urban planners in forced evictions, right? And how the forced evictions were undermining democratic planning processes. I also wanted to know what attempts, if any, had different levels of government made to adequately rehouse or relocate these residents, and what impact did public-private relationships have on the development associated with the Olympics? And lastly, and most importantly, what social impacts have been experienced by forcibly evicted residents? And would the most marginalized residents, so low-income residents of color, would they actually benefit from the Olympics-associated development? And to give you greater context, this is the Olympic map of Rio de Janeiro. So many of you may have heard of Copacabana, which is perhaps the most touristy part of the city. It's what's commonly referred to as the South Zone, right? Further north is Maracanã, which is the historic stadium. It's where the opening ceremonies of the Olympics were held. And then further west is the West Zone, also known as Barra de Tijuca. So Barra is nicknamed the Miami Beach of Rio, right? There's a lot of new money, a lot of new investment going into Barra. Where typically, it was a place where the marginalized lived, right? It's not in the city center. So what I found was that a lot of media coverage, a lot of the rhetoric coming from politicians justified the forced evictions that residents were experiencing by citing the fact that favelas were known for drug trafficking and for high rates of crime. And thus, these areas needed to be cleared because they were informal, and residents relocated to adequate and safe housing, right? So, in order to control for this variable in rhetoric, I decided to pick a favela that was not associated with drug trafficking, one that had relatively low levels of crime, and so I chose Vila do Drumo. So, Vila do Drumo is located in the West Zone, and it's been in existence for about 40 years. So, originally, it was a fishing village right off the waterfront of the lagoon, and there was a major public works project building the racetrack in Rio. And so many workers worked on that racetrack and then stayed in that area. And because affordable housing is very scarce in Rio, what we usually see is the building of informal settlements as a proactive way of residents to provide housing for themselves, housing that the private market nor the state is providing. And so, as you can see from this picture, it's not what you would typically envision in terms of an informal settlement or a shanty town. Many of the homes were built of cement, cinder blocks, many of them were multiple stories. Many of them housed businesses on the first level and family housing above. Some even had swimming pools. right? So Wheel Out to Dromel, by all accounts, was typically a working class neighborhood with very strong networks of solidarity amongst residents. But here's the issue. What you're looking at here is Wheel Out to Dromel, a working class neighborhood of about 4,000 residents, 900 families in 2013. And that raised area there is what will become the Olympic Village, right? So Wheel Out to Dromel sits on waterfront property and is directly adjacent to what will become the Olympic Village, complete with the Athletic Village and the International Broadcasting Center. So this is a rendering of the award-winning design by the architectural and planning firm AECOM. This design won out for the Olympic Village construction. The interesting thing about this initial rendering is, as you can see here in the far left corner, that's Wheel Out to Dromel. So the architectural firm included the favela in their design, right? But interestingly enough, somewhere between Rio de Janeiro and the presentation of the Olympic bid proposal in Switzerland, Wheel Out to Dromel got photoshopped out of this rendering. Right? And so, announcements were made on television that over 100 favelas will be targeted for eviction by the state. So, approaching this research, I knew that there would be a cultural disconnect, right? I'm an American planner trained in American planning principles, and I didn't want to view participatory planning or forced evictions through my own cultural lens. So I knew I needed to take a deeper look into what planning standards are in Brazil, right? And I found that the 1988 Constitution for Brazil is actually one of the most socially progressive in the world, okay? They have a right to housing, they have a right to health care, they have a right to leisure, which is not that surprising in a country known for carnival, right? And so I was interested in the fact that there is a constitutional right to housing. And I found that not only is there that constitutional right, but that the Constitution mandated the creation of a ministry of cities and corresponding local level councils to implement participatory planning, right? And that furthermore, there's actually an urban policy section of the Constitution. This warmed my heart as an urban planner, right? And in that urban policy section, it states that urban property has a social function, right? And the city statute of the urban policy section recognizes the right to the city, the role of the state and society in governing cities, and that collective interests should play a role in the development policies of municipalities. And most importantly to my study, the legalization of land occupied by low-income residents. So in Vila Alto Dromo's case, although they were an informal settlement, they were granted a 99-year lease by the state of Rio. The problem with that is 2 years after that lease was granted, the state transferred it to the city. So when the Olympics were announced, the city said, yeah, about that 99-year lease. And I deliberately chose the most unflattering pictures of politicians as I could for your enjoyment. So this is former Mayor Eduardo Paes. Okay. He was mayor of Rio during this time period. He wanted the world to remember him and his legacy as one of infrastructure investment. So Mayor Eduardo Paes authorized at least $6 billion in transportation infrastructure investments in Rio. This included rapid bus transport and also a dedicated subway line from Copacabana to the West Zone. In Rio de Janeiro and in Brazil in general, the political parties don't have decentralized financing as they do in the United States. So individual candidates are largely beholden to campaign donors. And what I found, when I dug a bit deeper into Eduardo Paes, I found that he'd been implicated in a few questionable land deals in the West Zone particularly land being sold to private developers for less than their valued cost, right? I also found that the real estate developers named in these allegations were his biggest campaign donors. And then enters Carlos Carvalho and Sarayla Development. So Carvalho owned a few thousand acres in the West Zone roughly since the 1970s. He had always anticipated that the city would begin to develop westward and was simply waiting for his investment to mature. Right? So his intention was to build luxury condominiums on land that was environmentally protected by legislation and directly adjacent to Villa Dodromo. So when asked about the forced evictions of residents in order to build his $2 million condominiums, he said, poor people should go to an area of the city where they deserve and where they can afford. The city center is for the elites. And so these are the Pure Islands luxury condos, right? So Ilapura, Pure Islands, when asked why he named the development this, he said because this will be a place of social purity. Okay? So these condominiums come with at least 5 parking spaces per condo, 3 bedrooms, an additional bedroom for maids' quarters, an additional bedroom for governesses. Each apartment comes complete with access to 2 elevators, and they are roughly 3 or 4 times the size of the average home in Villa Dodromo. And so when I looked into the fact that this land was protected by legislation from developmental encroachment due to its environmental value, I found that Eduardo Paes's government had actually circumvented participatory planning procedures and actually issued executive mandates for development. So this is all actually wetlands and marshlands that were protected as a part of the Tijuca rainforest. And so then I started looking into reports that transit policy had changed drastically in the 2 years preceding the Olympics. And what I thought was simply a case of civil unrest that would may or may not be related to an overall municipality policy of development, this particular line of inquiry changed my research drastically. So in 2013, Rio de Janeiro streets erupted into protests about a bus fare increase of roughly 50 cents to 75 cents, depending on the conversion rate, to which I thought was a minor fact, and I thought it was a protest based on principle. But when I looked into the history of Copacabana, I found something much more sinister at play. So the country of Brazil is roughly 51 to 52%. People of African descent, right? And so its cities are usually representative of that. Rio itself is representative of those statistics, but what I found is that the South Zone of Copacabana is about 80 to 85% white, and that there were concentrations of Black Brazilians in the north and western zones of the city. So under the tutelage of Dr. Ruth Steiner, transportation planner who was on my doctoral committee, I decided to reframe my approach to transit policy and not look at it as a more technical side of planning, you know, more generally associated with engineers, but actually approach it as a civil right and approach mobility as a human right. And what I found was that that bus fare increase was being used to subsidize the creation of the rapid bus transit system and of the dedicated metro line from Copacabana to Baja. So what we're talking about is low-income, disproportionately Black Brazilians paying for transit infrastructure for the elites. Right? I found that this was a violation of civil rights. I found that this doubled their transit time, because at the same time this type sort of infrastructure investment was happening, there was a strategic disinvestment in about 80 different bus lines, right? So the world over, empirical data shows that low-income communities disproportionately use buses, public buses, as a form of transit. Right? So Rio announced the elimination of 80 different bus lines. This doubled the travel time for most residents. It also eliminated a benefit, allowing them to transfer from one bus to another within a specific time period for free. This doubled the cost of their transportation. Right? And so what you're looking at is a picture of a frequent occurrence in Copacabana. So Copacabana having an abnormally concentrated population of white or mestizo Brazilians attacking a bus from the North Zone, right? So bus routes from the North Zone are commonly associated with Black Brazilians. And so when I looked into, after learning a bit more Portuguese, right? When I looked into Brazilian newspapers and looked at the editorial sections, I found that the letters to the editors often included remarks such as, "I pay too much money to live in Copacabana to see black garbage on my beach." Or, "I wish the police would do more to keep the black garbage in the North Zone where they belong." And so this picture was typical of the sorts of violence and attacks enacted by Copacabana residents on residents of the North and West Zone. And so the residents of the favelas were not victims, right? In the face of eviction threats, they actually organized, right? And they sought out assistance. And so two major bodies of assistance came from the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro and the Federal University of Fluminense, right? And so what happened was a coalition of social scientists came together to leverage their skill sets to articulate the priorities of residents facing these evictions. A coalition of engineers, of architects, of sociologists, anthropologists, helmed by urban planners. And so together with residents, they created what became known as the Popular Plan of Vila Chodromo. So this was an upgrading for the plan for the favela, with an estimated cost of about $3 million. This plan would integrate the favela with the Olympic Village and also get it onto the city's utility grid, right? So as you can see, the favela is there in the left corner. And so at the time of its adoption in 2012, the 900 families that were in Vila Chodromo had been whittled down to about 450. Right? So this plan was presented on international platforms, was presented to the mayor's office, right? At an estimated budget of $3 million to upgrade the favela, the city eventually spent $30 million to evict these residents. And as more residents left the favela, the plan had to be updated. So it went through about three revisions, each one showing fewer and fewer families and residences. Right? In 2013, it won the Urban Age Award, which is a joint international award awarded by Deutsche Bank and the London School of Economics. And urban planners on the award committee said that out of 80 different upgrading plans, they chose Vila Chodromo's popular plan as a show of solidarity, as a sign that they supported the urban planners and the other social scientists who were willing to help these residents resist. After being presented with the popular plan, the mayor's office chose to ignore it and to commit more forced evictions. So the plan was designed around the United Nations Habitat's key elements of good design. The plan was to contribute to social integration, equality, and diversity, to create compact, denser cities, for public spaces, parks, and playgrounds, and neighborhoods that remain active and lively even at night. It covered major areas such as housing, sanitation, public services, and even healthcare. But the removals began. Right? So the first to be removed were perhaps the most vulnerable population of Rio de Janeiro, the indigenous populations. And they were removed from the historic museum, which was located adjacent to the Maracanã Stadium, where the opening ceremonies were held. And I found that even in Vila Chodromo, as with favelas throughout the city being targeted for evictions. The evictions and demolition of these structures happen even with residents still inside. And for many residents who had no place to go, they actually returned to the rubble of their, in this case, partially demolished homes. And for many in the favelas, families are disproportionately led by women. And so strategic tactics and strategies were used to target women, particularly the use of threats about reporting women to child protective services and having their children removed if they did not leave their homes. Right. Women also reported having military police break into their homes in the middle of the night and waking up to men with guns above their beds. When those sorts of tactics didn't work fast enough, they deployed the military shock troops, which would be our equivalent of SWAT teams. And so here you can see the use of physical violence against residents. This included using tear gas against families and even children. And particularly the use of physical violence against the elderly. So the woman on the left-hand picture is Maria de Peña de Seña. And she said, "We weren't aggressive, but I was beaten." She was beaten by military shock troops who also used rubber bullets on residents. And she actually became a rising feminist figure in the resistance movement of not just Villa Tadromo, but favelas throughout the city. And in 2013, she won International Woman of the Year. And on the day that she went to accept her award, she left her home. She accepted the award, went to the ceremony, took pictures, and came home to find her home, and just her home, on fire. And so clashes with the military police erupted throughout the city. And Alba Mendez Brito said, "We are the victims of an event we don't want." And I watched all of this while watching international media coverage of the excitement and the anticipation of the 2016 Olympic Games. And so I went to Parque Carioca, which was one of the public housing developments in which forcibly evicted residents would be relocated. And it was a far cry from the flashy brochures and government publications. So upon arriving there, residents were given a choice of the key for key exchange, right? So giving up your home in Villa Tadromo and getting a key to a public housing unit in Parque Carioca. And so Parque Carioca happened to be about 4 kilometers west of a Villa Tadromo site, but residents of other favelas throughout the city were relocated up to 2 hours away from their original homes. Residents who arrived at Parque Carioca found that maintenance was to be conducted and done by residents. So the beautiful sparkling blue pool they saw in government publications, they found the person to be a green cesspool of mosquitoes, which is terrifying in a country that was in the middle of a Zika epidemic. They found that the development had no sort of infrastructure for communal spaces. So what we find is that typically in low-income neighborhoods, networks of solidarity are how people get by, right? You have to go to work so your neighbor watches your kids for you. Or if you're going through a tough time financially, your neighbor comes over with food for you and your family. This relocation completely dissolved those networks of solidarity. Even the built environment itself discouraged community. And so upon trying to enter Parque Carioca, I quickly found out that there were community managers on watch, only allowing actual residents in, and definitely not allowing American-presenting researchers in with cameras. But 20 families resisted out of 900. So in late July, before the Olympics, 20 families of Villa Tadromo were able to come to an agreement with the mayor's office for the city to build them new homes many of them much smaller than the homes they originally had demolished, right? And on the original site of El Autodromo. The residents reported that almost every infrastructure and developmental priority they articulated in the popular plan was ignored in the building of these 20 homes. So they were plagued with even more infrastructural issues, like immense flooding during heavy rainfall. Right. They also found that because of development and forced evictions, all of the vegetation flora that they had been proud of in their favela had been removed, torn down. And so they talked about how their neighborhood was now barren. And so I stood outside of the Maracanã as the opening ceremonies of the Olympics were going on. And I was watching them on a live stream, interacting with people, handing some a lighter as they burned Olympic flags. Probably not my most academically objective moment. Right? And I was floored by what I saw going on inside the stadium. And what you're seeing here is a picture of a part of the opening ceremony in which the favelas are depicted as a colorful, vibrant, sensual, rhythmic place, right? An integral part of the urban fabric of Rio, even as the city was demolishing them outside. So my study found that Afro-Brazilians were disproportionately impacted by the forced evictions and the decreased mobility resulting from the transit policies, and that the city's elites had actually mobilized political will to corral these black bodies in the west and north zones, and that they would almost exclusively benefit from these strategic infrastructural investments, and that urban governments at all levels had failed the most vulnerable of Rio's population. And that the ongoing events in Rio constituted egregious civil and human rights violations. But I also found that the 20 families who resisted, who still now reside in El Autodromo, many of them like Maria de Penha, who became international spokespeople for the resistance movement and forced evictions, represented hope and optimism about the future of resistance. Right. Through their efforts and the efforts of scholar activists from the university, the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro and the Federal University of Fluminense, they represented a healthy vein of resistance, right? But dispelled this myth that professors, academics, researchers were simply hiding in their ivory tower, not invested in the communities that their institutions were in. And I found that urban planners were at the helm of this resistance, not just locally, but through things like the Urban Age Award, were in conversation, right, with this international discourse about forced evictions, about the consequences of neoliberal-driven development. And I found that these scholar activists were willing to lend their time, their skill set, in some cases their safety, to aid the most marginalized. And I found that they would not be intimidated, and that really, they would be the academic rabble-rousers that may lead the charge against this continued rise in social inequalities. And most importantly, after learning far more Portuguese than I ever imagined, spending my entire summer on this wild emotional roller coaster of highs and lows in Rio de Janeiro, I came back to the United States and decided that I too wanted to be a scholar activist, that I too wanted to donate my time, right, my skill set, even my teaching to empower the marginalized, right? So I'm glad that I could share that with you today, and thank you.
Okay, let me open it up to questions from you and see who's got something to get started.
I have a point of clarification, because I read something vague about the bus fare protests of 2013, and you explained some more details, but I just want to make sure I got it straight. So So they implemented a roughly 50 cent a ride fare increase, eliminated 80 bus routes. Okay, but the protests were not by the people who were paying the extra 50 cents or had their bus route eliminated. The protests were by the people who didn't like having the African American population from the north coming through their neighborhood, rerouted through their neighborhood. Is that basically it?
No.
No.
No. So in 2013, there were protests throughout the city of low-income residents about the bus fare increases.
Okay.
That increase was followed in 2015 and 2016 by the announcement of eliminations of about 80 bus routes that were coming from the north and west zones, particularly on the weekends, right? Which gave the indication that there was a corralling of black bodies, meaning that it was okay for them to enter the city when their labor was necessary, Monday through Friday, right? But on the weekends, in terms of leisure, they would not be able to get access to the city center. The protests, the picture that I showed you of people attacking the bus, that is a frequent occurrence, particularly during the summer months, when Black Brazilians, people of darker skin, are coming on the weekends to the beach to Copacabana. So it's not, it's something separate that's also happening.
Okay.
I had the same question. Ultimately, do you have any numbers on how many people were forcibly evicted from their homes for the Olympics?
At the time of the actual opening ceremony, about 100,000. I just did work with research this past winter break, and the evictions have continued for the last year and a half. So we don't have official stats on that. And largely because when you're dealing with displacement, people disappear, right? So a lot of the people who took the key for key exchange, initially, the way public housing works in Rio, or in Brazil, is that usually after a 10-year period, you can sell your public housing unit. So many residents who took the key for key exchange were under the impression that they would own their units immediately. And so if need be, they could move closer to the city center and to their jobs, right? What they found out, and it's the topic of my most recent field work, is that they actually owed a 10-year mortgage. And they don't have any contracts in hand. Many of them were illiterate and signed what they were given based on verbal communication from city employees. And so upon finding out that they were straddled with this debt, that they would not be able to move closer, you know, sell this unit, many of them have left the units and moved in with friends and family and sort of fallen off the grid. So it's really hard to track people at this point.
Ty, what did they do with the land once the Olympics are through? It's a shame that some of those people, especially in those communal areas that were kind of segregated from one another, couldn't go back to the way it was in some way.
Yeah. So as with any other Olympics, So this one is better. So as with any other Olympics, typically the Olympic Village is sold on the private market. So for instance, 1996, the Atlanta Olympics, the Olympic Village became Georgia State University's dormitories, right? So in this case, developers were hoping for a windfall with these condominiums, right? So as of right now, Brazil's in its worst recession of its history, and those condominiums have sold about 10% of all units. So they were priced, particularly around the Olympic golf course, starting at $2 million and up, and Ilocora, that development was starting at $200,000 and up to $2 million per unit. In this case, the private real estate developers were granted exclusive rights to develop and sell the property after the Olympics. So the city does not profit from that, even though this was subsidized by public funds. So the Olympic Village is sitting empty right now.
Yes. I was going to say, there's a lot of vacancy, right? And is there any mobilization about what that should be any, or just kind of sits and rots?
I think the overwhelming sense that I got is that the most urgent matter to organize around is stopping the evictions. I mean, they're ongoing. So Rio's been in a state of forced evictions for the last 5 years. And so that tends to be what the urgency is around more so than what can we do. And they're privately owned. So there's that issue as well. And so, yeah, forcibly evicted residents can now see where their neighborhood used to stand and see that really it's all for nothing.
Sure. I'm curious, how much is this affecting the politics of the city? Is this, you know, you've talked about it, and we hear similar things in certain neighborhoods here, not to that degree, obviously, but it happens. And I'm curious, is popular opinion turned against, or is it not understood that this is happening, or is this on front page news, is this widely understood, or is this kept quiet and still moving forward?
It's very much so understood, but a huge part of this discussion is about the stigmatization of race in Rio and in Brazil, right? So typically favelas, like I said, are justified for removal by citing drug trafficking, right? High violence, high rates of crime and violence. And people of African descent are stigmatized as criminals, as thugs, as being undesirable, right? So even for Carlos Carvalho to speak openly about his development being a place of social purity, right? Many of these issues are framed as class issues in Rio, but when Black Brazilians make up 70% of the most impoverished residents, then you realize class is really just code for race. Right? So there's been long-standing stigmatization of these places, of the bodies that inhabit them. Right? So you see mobilization by residents, you see mobilization by the nonprofit groups that are on the ground, but the politicians have been framing this as a class issue for the last 500 years, right? And even when you look at the political structure and the major players, wealthy elites are white Brazilians, right? And that causes all sorts of hindrances to any sort of tangible change in the status quo. I mean, one major issue in Brazil is land reform, right? 14 families in Brazil own 70% of the land in the country, right? And have owned it for the last 500 years, right? And they sit on the land reform committee, right? So that sort of thing, you know, it's a place where there's corruption, you know, in every government, in every country, but Brazil just ousted its first female president, right, a month before the Olympics, over the largest corruption scandal in the world, right, the car wash scandal. So when you're talking about political will, I mean, Christopher Lash, you talked about the revolt of the elites, right? So the revolt of the masses is civil war. But the revolt of the elites is when elites can combine their economic power with political will and actually rip entire portions of the urban landscape away from the rest of the city for their own exclusive use, right? So when you're talking about a bus fare increase that pays for a dedicated line from Copacabana to Baja, Copacabana is 80% white and Baja is the new Miami Beach, right? So who's riding from Copacabana to Baja? It is, for a scholar activist that teaches about empowerment, that tries to aid and organize around empowerment, it is a daunting task in Brazil, just because the power structures there are so firmly ingrained. And when you're talking even about media coverage, a lot of the, I would say, the coverage that was actually exposing these forced evictions was international. The major media in Brazil and Rio is Globo, and a few years ago, Globo actually had to issue a public apology for supporting the dictatorship for 30 years. Okay? And it was actually their media outlets, their periodicals that I read with the letters to the editors about black garbage being on the beaches of Copacabana.
Do you see a lot of, or at moderate,
light or light-skinned Brazilians participating in allyship or amplification of Black voices, particularly public figures or media? Is there any media outlet that does that?
I mean, there any media outlet, sure, right? Is it a movement that is synonymous with lighter-skinned Brazilian allyship? No. Right? And that's mainly because it's, once again, classified as a class issue and an issue of criminality, right? And that has a lot to do with the way that developers, urban planners, and architects frame this, right? So we talk about informal communities. As someone interested in combating social inequalities, I talk about the fact that informal communities are a proactive way of solving market failure, right? Other urban planners would argue that informal communities are inherently illegal, right? And these people are not residents, they're squatters, right? And so they're also working against another phenomenon. So Vargas was at the head of a military coup that created a dictatorship in Brazil, right? And so he did a really interesting thing. His scholars like Anthony Marks at Columbia have looked into this, the making of race a nation, right? So when you look at the United States, there's been tremendous civil unrest due to racial inequality, right? So we had Jim Crow, legal segregation. You look at South Africa, they had apartheid, another form of legal segregation, right? So when Vargas was consolidating power, he wanted to avoid the sort of unrest that goes along with racial tensions, right? And so he decided to co-opt in a very deliberate and strategic way any sort of African tradition or ancestry in Brazil and make it a national identity, right? So Capoeira, for instance, started out as a martial art that African slaves engaged in as a form of resistance, right? It's actually a way to defend yourself, but it looks like dancing. And so because it was associated with Blackness and Africans, it was actually illegal for centuries in Brazil, right? Samba was the music of the favelas. It was music about resisting the status quo, right? Then there was even African foods, so feijoada, like in the United States, slaves were given the worst parts of meat, right? And so they developed ways to season their food to make it taste better. So if you look at feijoada, when I went down there, they said, oh, you have to have the national dish. I get there, and I'm a Southerner, I was like, oh, I know black-eyed peas and ham hocks when I see it, right? And it's because, much like in the U.S., right, Brazilian slaves were given the worst parts, and they made something that tasted great, right? This was a food associated with black people. So Vargas co-opted that, and now feijoada is the national dish of Brazil. It's not African, it's Brazilian now, right? Capoeira became legal, was co-opted into capoeira schools funded by the government, and now it's the Brazilian martial art, right? Samba was the music of resistance until the government started investing in samba schools. And the lyrics changed from songs of resistance to Brazil, how beautiful you are, right? So all of these things become Brazilian in a way that celebrates African traditions, but not the black bodies that accompany it. So you end up with a society that doesn't think about race in terms of inequality, right? Because we're not black and we're not white. And Cardoso, former president, famously said, we all have a foot in the kitchen. Trust me, it sounds more poetic in Portuguese. It's a very offensive way of saying we all have a little black in us, right? So if we all have a little black in us, we can't be racist, right? And famously, a census study reported over 100 different race categories in Brazil. In terms of shades of color, right? Not racial groups. And it was not uncommon, it still isn't uncommon to ask someone, like, você é negro? Are you black? And they say, no. Eu brasileiro, right? I'm Brazilian, I'm not black, right? So it's very difficult to organize, to identify inequality this way, and it also makes it very easy to dismiss racial inequality.
About the 20 families who were able to stay. What actions do they take to make that possible, even if it wasn't the ideal? So let me take a look at them. So these families arguably had the most resources, right, to resist. Right? So they had networks of friends, of allies, of finances in order to resist. So it's no surprise looking at this picture and seeing fewer faces of color. Right? One of the major issues I had in doing this research is that I was a little late to the game. So as a bright-eyed, bushy-tailed doctoral student, I'm on a plane to Brazil, and I'm like, I'm gonna crack this case wide open, and expose it to the world, right? And I get there, and I meet 200 academics who are like, oh, you just got here, right? And as I'm interviewing people, or not even interviewing, as I'm just speaking to people, residents start talking about spatial mismatch. And it becomes very apparent to me that they're experiencing what we call academic fatigue, right? We've been talking to too many academics and picking up our jargon. And so sometimes it's difficult. So I decided to scrap more of the ethnography part of my research and relying more so on non-participant observation and document review and field like site visits. So it was really difficult to find out in each particular case why they were successful in resisting. But getting second and third hand accounts of some of the on the ground personnel that I just happened to meet there, these were the families that had the most networks and resources and able to resist. I mean, that's why it's 20 families out of 900.
You don't need to go back to the slide you were just on that showed the village site before it was developed. What was that land prior to the Olympics?
Undeveloped. I mean, this was prime real estate. It was waterfront property that the city had not been interested in developing before this. Maybe you have in 07, you have Rio hosting the Pan American Games, which the political elites were using as a training ground for proving they could host a mega sporting event like the World Cup and the Olympics. So there was talk then in 07 about evictions and maybe developing this land. But they ended up rehabbing some areas adjacent to the racetrack that were already developed. But now when you see this area, I mean, it's almost not even recognizable. Villa Autonoma residents had previously described it as paradise, as a peaceful place where you could hear birds chirping all day long. So a lot of this was undeveloped land, particularly the land owned by Carlos Carvalho that was adjacent to the favela. He just owned the land and had been waiting basically 30 years for the right opportunity to develop it.
Tommy, long ago, Janice Perlman wrote The Myth of Marginality, and changed lots of people's thinking both about favelas and about settlements and about Brazil and about Rio. And that amount of time, Spargas was successful in kind of the public face, wasn't it? I mean, you know, it really changed. People really thought lots of these things weren't there, but underlying.
Right, I mean, Nelson Mandela talked about Brazil being a model for South Africa.
Yeah.
Right? And that has a lot to do with Jeboko Gray's idea of racial democracy,
mm-hmm.
right? The Brazilian race that Brazil had transcended racial inequality and tension, and that unlike the U.S., unlike South Africa, there was never any violence or uprising due to racial inequality. So I think Vargas was great at PR. I mean, you look at Carnival, and there's all sorts of propaganda. a way of Carnival was really an activity of the masses, and he made it into a tourism product, right? Because you could export. I often ask my students when I teach about Brazil, navigating blackness in Brazil, I ask them to imagine in their mind a Brazilian woman. And then I ask them, what does she look like? And they say, wavy black hair, kind of caramel skin, curvaceous. And then I say, did you know that Brazil is 52% black? And then they're floored. And it's like Brazil has the largest black population outside of Africa. And if you include Africa, it's only second in the world behind Nigeria.
So I tell them the fact that you don't think of a black woman when you think of Brazil is a result of Vargas's PR campaign, because he used to have direct his tourism ministry to send out flyers of mulatto women. That is why the world thinks of Brazilian women as looking one way.
Okay? How does that story play out in Recife and the places to the north, where there is a stronger African focus, or at least the revival of the African focus?
Right. So for places like Recife, like, I looked more so at the impact of the World Cup, for instance, and the stadium building there. But you find the same things. I mean, even if you look at Salvador and Bahia, right, which is arguably 85% black, right? Blacks are marginalized out of the political process, right? They're marginalized out of economic power. So even there, you have the same sort of elite structure that basically can do what it wants in terms of urban development, right, and policy. So even it kind of furthers my teaching goals and my involvement in the academy when I say it's not enough to put more bodies of a certain type to enact change, right? So there's more black bodies in Salvador than arguably anywhere else, right? But the events still play out the same way, right? They're excluded from power, and that's the issue. And so in places like I said, in places like Salvador, when you look at stadium building, they've got white elephants, right? Huge unused stadiums from the World Cup that follow the same development policies, using public funds to subsidize these mega sporting events for the benefit of a few wealthy elites.
I just came back from Cuba a while ago, and there it's very ironic because individual people of dark skin usually and often know exactly where they came from in Africa, because that's the way the Spanish did things.
Right.
But they identify as Cubans in a different way. And that's what I, and it sounds like, if you were cynical, you could say, oh, Fidel won his public relations job. And then he convinced those Africans who had done poorly before that they were coming forth and being Cubans. Fidel is, of course, he's increased the amount of cultural expression and some of the economics. So do you think Fidel was just successful, or do you think that I'm Cubano, do you think that's an indigenous, not a propagandized thing?
So, I mean, there are scholars like Devin Spence Benson, right, who discuss how Fidel needed the support of black Cubans, right? And so lured them with the rhetoric that they would find racial equality under his regime, right? And they were quickly disillusioned by that, right? Because it does not happen. And so they do identify openly as black, right? And I don't mean to dismiss any sort of racial identity, because black Brazilians do identify as black in many cases, in an increasing number, right? So I don't want to dismiss as though they're just oblivious, right? It is very clear that there are different, for them now, in more recent years, it's more very clear that there are inequalities based on black and brown skin color, right? And I think the same is true for Cuba, and you see it even in their cultural expression, right? So Herbert Marcuse argued that marginalized political actors go to the arts event, right? So what we see in Cuba through public murals, through music, is a lot of black, particularly black feminist critiques of communism, of Castro, right? Of these broken promises of racial inequality in Cuba. And we see the same things occurring in Brazil, right? So you have the Movimento Negro, which is still very strong, right? Even in terms of, when I mentioned Vargas co-opting Carnival, in Salvador and Bahia, you have the Negro, the Bloco Negro, right? The black bloc of Carnival, right? Which is a cultural and institutional memory instrument of when blacks were banned from Carnival, right? And now they've co-opted that and taken it back. So there is racial identity coalescing around this, just not to the extent that you would picture due to the United States or the history of South Africa, right? And I think a large part of that has to do with the repressive nature of the dictatorship.
There's another question behind
you.
Oh,
sorry.
Still have your
okay.
I'll go.
Okay. A certain number of years ago, I saw a speaker He was a white journalist from South Africa. He was an anti-apartheid activist while it was still in place. And he gave his presentation and he said, if you looked at the legal codes of apartheid, there were something like 300 and some odd statutes specifically embodying apartheid, but he said only one needs to be changed, and that is the one that prohibits black people from having a meaningful vote. In your research, do you think there is a linchpin in this political system that would have similar impact in Brazil?
I'm doubtful. And I say that because there's actually anti-racist legislation on the books in Rio, in Brazil, right? It's illegal to be racist in Brazil. But people are, right? So for instance, they have a constitutional right to housing, right? But they're evicted anyway. They have a 99-year land tenure lease, but they're evicted anyway, right? If you apply, if you're applying for jobs in Brazil, oftentimes you'll see aparência boa, right? A good appearance will be stated, right? Well, a good appearance is a not black appearance, right? So it's the unspoken ways, and sometimes spoken in that case, right? Ways that things operate. So for instance, residents have formed class action lawsuits and filed them to oppose the forced evictions in Rio, right? But the judicial often sides with the legislative bodies, right? To protect their power, right? They feel that an attack on the legislative branch is an attack on the judicial branch, which is an attack on the executive branch. So they often protect each other in a way that, remembering my own cultural lens, right? In a way that is the antithesis of checks and balances of democratic government, right? So in that way, I would argue that all of these violations are illegal, right? There's legislation on the books that makes them illegal, right? But it's the ways in which they're not enforced that's more so the issue.
Of the various Olympic sites in Brazil, were there any that were adjacent to more upper class neighborhoods or white neighborhoods that had any sort of public backlash? Like, oh, the Olympics are great, but maybe I'm not in my backyard common, or anything like that?
In my experience, no. So for instance, volleyball was hosted on the beach of Copacabana, right? There was no sort of what we would phrase as NIMBYism going on in Copacabana about it, right? A lot of wealthy elite Brazilians were very public and vocal about being proud of this opportunity to show the world how wonderful Brazil is, right? And how Rio is the center of cultural life in Brazil. The picture I showed you in the beginning of Brazilians cheering on the beach was a viewing party of the IOC announcement on Copacabana, right? So you have a portion of the population that is very supportive of this, right? In terms of a national identity, right? And you know, municipal pride, and then those most affected are the ones that are most marginalized and without voice. I think it's really interesting to just dissect the opening ceremony imagery because Brazil has what they call a para inglês ver, so like for the English to see. It's kind of like when company comes over, you sweep everything under the rug. And so that was what the opening ceremony was. And a common trope in Brazilian political history is to acknowledge your wrongs and then move on, right? So if you watch the opening ceremony, you see that they show the indigenous population that was decimated. They show depictions of slavery, right? And then it's like, there's also this underlying theme of Brazil being compared to the US, right? So it's kind of a subliminal jab at the US, like we acknowledge our wrongs, but let's move on, right? And showing, and like for the English to see, right, showing the favelas, as this beautiful cultural, you know, site of cultural production while demolishing them at the same time. And so I think that's something that's very common to Brazilian history, political history at least.
Okay. Well, time. I wanted to, yeah, thank you very much. This was great.